Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders, past and present, and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening to us on our website or on the podcast later on 989fm.com.au, welcome to you as well. This morning, our guest is Temi Solonik from Amnesty International. She's actually just been over at the United Nations in Geneva for the Australian government's four-year, they do it in four-year increments, so the second universal periodic review where they actually review our human rights record. So we got Temi on the line all the way over from Perth, very early hours in Perth at the moment. Temi, how are you this morning?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, first of all, what's your mob and country?
I'm Nigina from Derby in the Kimberley of Western Australia, but I've lived down here on Noongar Boodja since I was 16, so I've been in Perth a long time.
Yeah, know that country very well, I can imagine.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city.
When did you get back from Geneva? Only recently, didn't you?
Yeah, I got back on Friday night.
Yeah, so a bit over the jet lag at the moment.
Yeah, I had Monday off work, so that was nice recovery time. But, yeah, it's only 7 hours difference from here, from Perth to Geneva, so it wasn't too bad.
We're talking about the Universal Periodic Review today. Can you tell us a little bit about that review? Because it's only Australia's second time it's happened for Australia, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a relatively mechanism of the United Nations where every member state, and there's 193 members of the United Nations, so countries, every 4 to 5 years they judge every country on their human rights records. It's supposed to be judged against the seven core human rights treaties, but it's also a bit broader than that. Like, they'll look at the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. We've been saying everywhere that it's 4 years, but the review is actually every 4.5 years. And the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights is talking about extending that out to 5 years because there's so much interest in the review that every time they run it for each country, more and more people are coming and it's creating a lot more work for them. But yeah, because it's a fairly new mechanism, everyone's still sort of finding their way with it. But what happens is every country comes before the UN. They can submit questions in advance to the nation that's being reviewed, and then they can also put questions on the floor. So it depends on how many countries line up to ask questions of that particular country. And they work in alphabetical order. So, like, we were in the afternoon on Monday last week, and before us in the morning was Austria. So it's a really interesting mechanism within the UN, and it really is growing in attention, and it's certainly becoming something that we can look at a lot more in terms of Indigenous rights. One of the advantages of the UPR as compared to other mechanisms is that it takes all the human rights issues and you can look at them in one. So in terms of advocacy, you can get a lot of stuff done in the one mechanism. Whereas, say, if you wanted to look at something else and take it to a committee of the United Nations, you'd have to break down and say, okay, this article applies to that convention, so I need to go to this committee. Whereas the UPR is a bit of a catch-all. So it's a really interesting mechanism, and we're really pleased with the media attention and the number of Indigenous and other minority groups who have really jumped on to the UPR and promoted it to civil society.
This all comes in the backdrop of Australia wanting to, Australia's nomination to be on the Human Rights Council in 2018. I mean, does this UPR affect that nomination in any way?
Yeah, look, it does, because before a country can be accepted onto the Human Rights Council, they have to establish that they're a good citizen in the world and that they have a good human rights record, or if they don't have a good human rights record, that they'll be doing a lot in recent years to rectify whatever human rights concerns there are. So one would argue with this review that Australia hasn't come up too well. There was, out of the 192 nations that could have asked us questions, 107 asked questions.
Oh, wow.
That's a big interest. So people are quite happy to sort of point the finger at Australia, because I think Australia points its finger at other countries a lot. So we'll have to see how the bid goes, but we do think this would negatively affect the bid. We just have to see what happens.
And when you talk about Aboriginal affairs, obviously a big part of that has been the Indigenous incarceration rates. Were there a number of questions raised around incarceration specifically?
Yeah, there were. Just getting to them. Well, there was a few questions about juvenile justice system in particular. Countries including Lithuania, Poland, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Lithuania again, Iceland and Paraguay, they all made specific questions about our juvenile justice system and its impact on Indigenous kids. They said that we need to remove mandatory minimum sentencing of juvenile offenders, that we need to improve youth detention facilities, and that we need to raise the age of criminal responsibility. Under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the age should be 12. You shouldn't lock kids up who are less than 12, but in every jurisdiction in Australia, we lock up 10 and 11-year-olds, so that was called out as well. But there were more general recommendations about the justice system generally and how it affects Indigenous people, including mandatory sentencing, including access to justice for Indigenous people to make sure they've got access to lawyers and that the legal services are well funded.
In relation to mandatory sentencing, I was reading in one of the, I think it was the supplementary reports or the stakeholder reports, it actually talks about the fact that from the previous UPR review, Australia's actually extended mandatory sentencing laws in other states. So Australia hasn't really shown that it's taken this mechanism very seriously, hasn't it, in the past 4.5 years when the previous one has been done?
Yeah, well, look, there's a lot of things that Australia didn't improve on. But yeah, with the juvenile justice and the justice system stuff, it is difficult because the states and territories implement those laws. So, and then it's the federal government that goes over to the United Nations and gets grilled. And Philip Ruddock came to our side event and we were having a bit of a dialogue with him about that. And he was saying about the difficulties of the federal system. And we were sort of saying, well, that's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, you just need to find ways. The UN doesn't look at that jurisdictional stuff. They have the same problems in America. So I think they were listening to what we were saying, but there's a lot of work still to go there. The federal government doesn't see these issues as a problem that they should be working on. But really, when the international community is scrutinising, then I think they do need to start looking at themselves and working on some federal leadership. Like another area that's gone backwards is the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture. So if this protocol was signed, Australia would have to set up what's called a national preventative mechanism, and that would allow UN inspectors to come and inspect all places of detention to ensure that they comply with international standards. So that would include prisons, juvenile detention centres, police lockups and refugee centres.
Right.
And Australia said, yeah, so it's a really important thing for us. And Australia said they'd ratify it. Under the previous government, they sort of started to work towards it. Then we had a change of government, and then the government that we've got in now have done nothing. So I just counted 27 states who specifically said to Australia, you told us you were going to ratify OPCAT and you haven't.
Yeah, right. But we all know the reason why, isn't it? I mean, Australia wouldn't want to ratify it given that their domestic policies, are directly in contravention to that treaty.
That's right. But, I mean, the way it works is the UN inspectors will come in and find what's wrong and make recommendations to bring Australia into line with the standards. So it's a good thing for Australia. And we need our government to understand that these international standards will improve Australia's human rights record if they're complied with.
Another sort of issue that kept coming up for me in the recommendations was about governance and self-determination for Aboriginal peoples. Mm. And there was a lot of talk about the National Congress in particular. I mean, is that a big problem? Or how does Australia respond to that problem about self-determination? Because I know that sort of word is very, controversial to a state like Australia.
Yeah, it was interesting actually. Some of the nations specifically mentioned the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And with regards to Congress, Peru in particular said that that Australia should continue to support Indigenous institutions that bring cohesion to communities such as the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples. I think they're the only one that specifically mention Congress. But there's also a number of recommendations saying that we need the right to participate in decisions that affect us and to have good mechanisms like Human Rights Acts to protect us. So in terms of what will happen with them, whether the UN, whether Australia will, you know, take up these recommendations, Australia has until March to accept or reject the recommendations. They're going to be holding a civil society forum in Canberra on the 9th of November, where the NGOs and civil society members who are at Geneva or who've been involved in the UPR process can come and lobby them to accept or reject again. So we won't really know until then what they're going to do with that. I mean, implementing the declaration into domestic law is a fairly new thing as well, and not many countries have done it, and it's developing, so there's a lot of work to be done there. But yeah, we just have to see. And the other thing that sort of should happen from the government between now and March is they need to work on a process of how they're going to monitor the recommendations. So, for example, New Zealand has an amazing website. You can go onto the website, you can check out all the specific recommendations and monitor how New Zealand is tracking at getting them on track for the next UPR. So we don't really have anything like that. We questioned the government in the UPR debrief meeting we had the day after at the permanent mission, and they said that the New Zealand one was the gold class version. I'm not sure if Australia will get that. But there's a lot of work for us to do to continue to push Australia to have a good process for reviewing and implementing the recommendations.
What was the case 4.5 years ago with the previous UPR review? I mean, doesn't Australia have to give up a report about how it's going to start implementing that? I mean, is there a lot of confidence that Australia will actually put in place proper mechanisms to start implementing these recommendations? Or given past history, I guess is it maybe it's a bit cynical to think that, but like what's the outlook in relation to Australia actually doing that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the change of government was difficult, because you had one government accepting and rejecting recommendations and a new government coming in and not wanting to be held by what a previous government had said. So that is really difficult. But I think there is monitoring that went on in the period between the first review and this one that's just happened, in particular the Australian Human Rights Council. And they're actually what's called a national human rights institution. Each country is supposed to have one, and they fill a really specific role within the United Nations. So they have been monitoring. They've put out yearly reports, and then their 2015 report was quite a long one. There's also the NGO report. There was about 140 NGO organisations that contributed to a joint submission. And then there was organisations like Amnesty. We go out alone. That's just our policy. So we had our own submission. The NATSLs put in one of their own. There was a few individual submissions as well. And all of those mechanisms do offer a way of reviewing government, but what we really want is them to do it better themselves. Yep. We know they put in a report, they have to put in a report, but the report, I wrote an opinion piece about what I thought about the report before I went, and, you know, there was a lot of things that they would say that were helping Aboriginal people that weren't. Like, they kept pointing to constitutional reform as something that wonderful they're doing for Aboriginal people, but it didn't say how much disagreement in the community there is. Yep. It didn't say how much money's already been spent with no result. It didn't say that the process has stalled so many times. You know, and it also pointed to their Indigenous advancement strategy in their report. And they were saying that was a wonderful thing.
As a positive thing.
Yeah, it didn't say it'd taken $550 million out of Indigenous programs. That's why it's really important for civil society to put in their own reports, because otherwise you'll get this tainted, one-sided government view of it.
In relation to constitutional reform, there were a few recommendations from states about ensuring that process continues, but only a couple about specifically removing racial discrimination from the constitution, which is what everyone really wants. I mean, do you think that recommendation is really understood that well, given that it is such a controversial issue?
No, not well, look, we have to look at our constitution rationally and look at it with all the other constitutions in the world, and it is one of the most racist constitutions in the world, and there's some horrific provisions that just need to go. And so there was actually a whole series of recommendations about racial and social cohesion and eliminating racism and discrimination against minorities in Australia, including Indigenous people, people with disabilities, ethnic minorities, Muslim people. So it was in there. It just wasn't connected to the constitutional reform stuff. They were saying we need a Human Rights Act. They were saying we need some sort of legislative process or some sort of mechanism to allow people to access remedies when they're discriminated against. But a lot of them weren't saying that had to be in the constitution. But, yeah, I think that the constitutional stuff, I mean, there were a few countries that specifically noted it, so Georgia and Sri Lanka and the Republic of Korea, interestingly.
Well.
And I know some people have come out saying, you know, why are we listening to Korea and these sorts of places that are known for human rights abuses? But the thing is, it's our review. When it comes to their review, we can say what we like. But that was our review, and they have a right to say what they like to us. So we still have to listen to what all the countries are saying.
Where do you see the process of constitutional reform at the moment, given we're at a time when we're still waiting for the referendum council, I guess, to be announced? I mean, how do you see it reflected in the Aboriginal community, particularly the people you talk to?
I think people are really frustrated that it's taken so long, that there's so much disagreement. It appears to me that there are two issues. One is recognition and one is reform. So the recognition is about, you know, putting in new parts of the constitution which recognise Aboriginal people. And I understand that the sovereignty arguments, they say if we do that, that exceeds our sovereignty. But then the other issue is the reform of the racist elements. Section 25 is really racist. Section 51.26 allows governments to make laws for the detriment of a particular race, so that's not a good law either, and they need reform. So I think if you could split it up into those two issues, you'd have Aboriginal people saying, yep, let's get rid of the racist stuff. But the recognition is actually, I'm finding that a lot of people are very confused about that and wonder what benefit that's going to provide to us.
Do you think it's just gone, because it's dragged on for 5 years now, is it just at a point where a lot of blackfellas are sort of so cynical now that there's no way back to actually looking at the, you know, the concrete reforms that we could actually make to the constitution? Do you think it's, in a way, a lost cause?
Look, I think it has narrowed to a point because there's been so much discussion about it. Like, I would have liked to have seen dedicated seats in Parliament. I would have liked to have seen bolder things for Indigenous people, but we're past that point. We have narrowed. I don't know whether it's a lost cause, but there has been so much invested in it. And it is good to have reached this narrow point. But me, as a lawyer and someone who's been studying the Constitution since I was 17, I want to see a draft bill. You know, like, I want to see what is the amendment you're suggesting, and then I can analyse it and think about it. But until we have a proposal, until we have an amendment to debate, it's pretty hard to say whether you support it or not.
Yeah. I think it's more to do with the current political climate, not including Aboriginal voices. I think a lot of Aboriginal people have just been completely sidelined when we do have a lot of voices like yourself and a lot of legal experts out there who are talking about a strong way forward, but we do seem to be limited to this just recognition debate because it's sort of dumbed down for white Australians as well, because there's this perception that it would never pass at a referendum if you wanted to put in concrete reforms to remove racial discrimination.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's pillars towards a successful referendum. The first pillar is bipartisan or multi-party ownership, and so you have to get all the parties agreeing so you can get a bill up before Parliament. And with the current stance saying, let's just do recognise, the parties are all like, yep, let's do that. That works well. So you get past the first pillar. But then the final pillar is popular ownership. Yep. You have to come up with something that all of Australia is going to vote yes for. And my argument was if you extend it to be a debate about race, about all race, to get rid of the racist provisions, then you'd get everyone on board. You'd get, you know, the Muslims and the Chinese and the Asian and everyone who comes from a different race would be on board with that.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't get past that first pillar of popular ownership, of bipartisan support, because they don't want a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. So it's a bit of a catch-22, really, and we are at a difficult spot with it.
Yeah, that's very true. And I just wonder what you think of the actual Recognise campaign. I mean, it has been largely, you talked about it, it actually is going to affect all sort of minorities, I guess, but it has been largely targeted towards Aboriginal people. What do you see as the role of the Recognise campaign in all of this?
Well, I mean, they're funded to do a specific job, which is to, you know, create support and awareness for the need for constitutional recognition. I think it should have been for constitutional reform. It could have been broader, but that was the decision that they made. They thought that was going to, you know, win people over, and perhaps they need to look back on that. You know, I think Unity was working well. Then we had Recognise, and then we also had the Joint Select Committee, and we had the expert panel, and we've had all these different components to it. But I guess we've all invested so much in it. You know, you want to see where it goes. But at this stage, it's just a bit of a guessing game because it's a changing beast.
The Amnesty, in your submission, you actually, to the UPR, you actually did bring up a Human Rights Act. I mean, why would it be important? I mean, Queensland's actually looking at putting in a Human Rights Act now. They're looking into consultations around it. Can you tell us a little bit about Human Rights Act and what that would actually do?
Yeah, well, most countries have some form of human rights legislation. In Australia, when we sign up to international conventions, it does not automatically become domestic law. We need to have some sort of legislation implemented. So, for example, the Racial Discrimination Act is pretty much a word-for-word duplication of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. So we've got that in domestic law. We've got domestic law for disability rights and for most sort of rights. But there's a lot of human rights that are not legislated, in particular economic, cultural and social rights, your right to housing, your right to education, those sorts of things. We've got quite a lot of good civil and political rights, but there's other rights like the rights of migrant workers, the rights of people with disabilities is improving, but all the ones that have been missed, that's where we sort of need a piece of legislation that will cover that stuff and provide mechanisms. And it's not just about having a law, it's about providing a way that people can seek solutions to problems that are human rights issues. And a lot of that might be through conciliation. Say someone's been racially vilified or targeted because of their race or culture, then because we've got the Racial Discrimination Act, they can go through the Human Rights Commission and lodge a conciliation complaint and try and conciliate it with that person before some sort of, you know, racially motivated violence erupts. So it's about making a safer society for everyone, and we're behind the eight ball. We don't have these sorts of rights guaranteed for us. It would be better, in my opinion, if it was in the Constitution, because a Human Rights Act can just be suspended by the whim of government. But at the minimum, we need a Human Rights Act. And we had this huge, big consultation a number of years ago. I think it was like 40,000 submissions, and 80% of them said they wanted a Human Rights Act, but we still didn't get one. So a lot of the countries were pulling us up on that and saying you need better legislative protection of human rights.
When you talk about legislation just being, you know, sort of bypassed at the will of Parliament, another thing that came up in the stakeholders report was, I think it was by the National Congress, was the issue of the special measures and what constitutes a special measure under the Racial Discrimination Act, which you mentioned before and which obviously has been bypassed to curtail Aboriginal rights. Was that something that came up at the UPR coming from that stakeholders report?
No. I mean, I've got the summary of all the recommendations in front of me, and I was just looking at it before we spoke, and I can't see anything specifically about special measures, but it might be in there. I mean, you have to remember that they only had a minute each. So, you know, a lot of them were speaking very quickly, and I'm sure they had more to say, but they would have just sort of spoken generally about the need for human rights protections. I can do a control find to see if it's in there, but it's not.
No, I didn't see it in there either, yeah. I guess it is. It's very hard to sum up the problems of the country's human rights record in just an afternoon. I guess it's sort of a very complicated process, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, well, I mean, they can submit questions in advance, and a few countries did do that. But look, I think it's a pretty good mechanism. I live tweeted for 4 hours and it was pretty exhausting. Maybe it could go longer, but there's, you know, there's 193 nations of the world to look at, and the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights is a pretty busy job doing all of this. So I think half a day was good. And I think that there'll be more and more interest. We also held a side event. So we held that just before Australia's UPR. And we had a real focus on Indigenous rights. We had me and Mick Gooda, our Social Justice Commissioner. We had Les Mauser from the National Congress. We had Damien Griffiths from the First Peoples Disability Network. And we had Gillian Triggs, the President of the Human Rights Commission. And we really focused on Indigenous rights. So that gave us an opportunity as well. Then there was a diplomatic event after the UPR to honour Mick Gooda, actually. So it had a real Indigenous flair to it. I mean, if you saw all the mainstream media, you would have seen it just said refugees, refugees. That's the big thing that Australia was slammed on, and we were. But Indigenous rights was just as big.
Yeah, right. Like, Why doesn't Indigenous rights get that level of coverage? Because I noticed that too. Asylum seekers, obviously, were all over the thing, and it's not a competition, obviously, but, yeah, you didn't see a lot in the media about Aboriginal rights.
I think it reflects the general public's in Australia's view, because that's what sells the newspapers and that, that there's this apathy about Indigenous rights. You know, oh, that's an issue that's been going on for a long time. It's like a festering wound. There's nothing we can do about it. So people don't want to hear about it. They close their ears off because it's too hard for them to deal with.
Yeah.
The refugees is a little bit more, it's something that's more new for Australia that we're really trying to grapple our way through. But what it did tell me is that given that I'd say a good, you know, half, and I need to count them all up, but really, really strong messages coming out for Indigenous rights is that even though within Australia there might be this apathy and people can't deal with it anymore,
yeah,
the world community is looking on at us. They see the Indigenous rights human issue, the Indigenous human rights issues in Australia to be just as serious as the refugee issues. Yeah. And Australia needs to listen to that.
We might go to a break and we'll come back shortly with Tammy Solonik from Amnesty International, who's just come back from Geneva at the UN, where they've just undertook Australia's 4.5 yearly Universal Periodic Review, and we'll be back shortly after the break. Welcome back to Let's Talk. My guest today is Amnesty International's Tammy Solonik, who's been over in Geneva at the UN. We just listened to Changing Times there by Titters. Tammy, I was just wondering, there was a lot also about violence against women raised at the UN, and that was in your submission as well, Amnesty's submission. I mean, when we talk about Aboriginal women particularly, is that something that comes up given that we do have higher rates of family violence in our communities?
Yeah, there were a number of countries that talked about the need to step up efforts to combat domestic violence, and particularly against women and children. But a number of countries also said that should be particularly for women in remote areas and from women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. That one what I was reading there is just from Croatia. But Singapore was talking about Indigenous people, Indigenous women, and the Czech Republic and Pakistan, and there's quite a few of them. So that came up as a consistent theme, that if Australia is going to work on its domestic violence issues, they have to remember Indigenous women and they have to remember people in regional and remote areas. Actually, the incidence of DV is a bit higher in regional areas. So, and you know, they don't have the same access to services, and we know that a lot of our mob live in regional and remote areas.
Yeah, and I was very interested. I was reading through the stakeholders report and I never heard this one statistic, and it was a statistic raised by, I think it said, the International Council of Jurors. And it was that there had been a 74% increase since 2000 of Aboriginal women in prison. And I knew it was going up higher and higher, but that just seemed like such an extreme statistic, that the fact that Aboriginal women are being incarcerated 74%, there'd been a 74% rise in Aboriginal women jailed since 2000. So that's only 15 years. I mean, that's quite shocking to me. I mean, I know that obviously the statistics are probably similar, you know, that was probably around it, but just hearing it like that just felt really shocking, just the number of Aboriginal women we jail.
It has been going up recent years. I didn't realise it was that high either. But And we're seeing a lot of young girls commit violent offences that they never used to. And a lot of it is related to domestic violence. Mm. So these kids, you know, girls and women have been putting up with this stuff for so long, and then once they fight back, they get in trouble.
Yeah.
So there are real, there is a real concern, a real need for more programs for women and girls. I mean, our men are still incarcerated and detained at much higher rates. But, yeah, this stark increase in women and girls shows the need for more programs for them. And those sorts of things are starting. With regards to domestic violence and the safety of women and children, Australia was actually commended for its new action plan on domestic violence, which they've just committed $100 million for, and $21 million of that was dedicated to Aboriginal family and domestic violence. So that was actually seen quite well by the community, and probably lucky for Australia that they've reacted in this way to recent events recently, because they were able to boast about that. Another area where Australia was commended was disability rights. And in particular, the National Disability Insurance Scheme was seen as first class. A lot of countries around the world are looking to follow our lead on that. And Damien Griffiths, I know from the First Peoples Disability Network, was really pleased with a number of the recommendations, specifically mentioning people with disabilities who are Indigenous.
Yeah.
And the impact of them on incarceration. So it was actually a good win for disability rights, although we need to, you know, keep the pressure on to ensure that the rollout of the National Disability Insurance Scheme is effective and that it includes Indigenous people.
Was there any talk about the indefinite detention? I know this is a problem that the First Nations Disability Network has raised a number of times around, obviously, people with disabilities being incarcerated indefinitely for certain crimes. I think it mostly happens in WA and the NT. Was there any show from Australia, or I heard there had been an announcement prior to that, but was there any talk about that, about the problem of indefinite detention?
Yeah, it did come up. I'm just trying to look for the exact one, because I remember Damien retweeting it, and I do remember hearing it. There was one specifically about prevent the indefinite detention of persons with mental disabilities from Spain. And another one from Holy See, and another one from New Zealand. So, that was an issue. And just for people who don't know, in some jurisdictions, if you plead insanity, or if you say that you're not of the mental state when you were committing a crime, then in some jurisdictions in Western Australia, you can be detained at the governor's pleasure. So we see people who are unfit to stand trial just get locked up for longer than if they'd even pleaded guilty. And that's a real issue. And that came up in the UPR debrief that we did the next day. And I think it was Ruddick, he'd said that this particular issue had caught the attention of the Attorney General, Brandis, and that they should move on that. So I hope that there'll be some pressure on that, and I hope we'll see some movement in that area, because it's terrible that people can get locked up forever without even being convicted of a crime.
That particularly is quite an area of concern, considering we're talking a lot about FASD and that's slowly becoming an issue, particularly amongst our mob. I mean, there was a high-profile case in the Northern Territory of a woman who had quite severe fetal alcohol syndrome. She'd been locked up for a number of years. I think her name was Rosalie Fulton. So it's continually going to be a problem, aren't we, because we're facing these really horrific sort of generational development problems.
Yeah, I mean, our mob are overrepresented in those areas as well. There was also the case of Marlon Noble, where he was locked up for such a long time, and it was only through the fierce advocacy of a social worker that his case was brought to light. So it is a real concern for our people. And with the FASD, we are having some traction there, but there's still a lot more to be done. We want it to be recognised as a disability so that the carers get access to carers allowance. We want to have a diagnostic tool developed. And we want our kids who have these behavioural issues to receive the help and support they need rather than just being removed from family and locked up. So I think we're getting somewhere on FASD, but there is still quite a way to go. And we face the same issues that we face with all the stuff that affects the day-to-day lives of our mob, which is that stuff is legislated by the state governments and the federal governments often don't intervene. So it's different in each state and territory.
Although I remember, I think a consistent call, particularly from legal groups, has been for justice targets to be included in the Closing the Gap targets, which the federal government seems just not to be, you know, willing to work towards, are they? Is that something that the federal government could do that would help get around this problem, around the state and territory responsibility?
Yeah, well, that's something that we've been asking for some time. This current federal government seems to have no appetite for it. Nigel Scullion's said quite outright that it won't happen. But I noticed on Facebook last night that Bill Shorten's actually giving an address, I think in Melbourne today, about just that topic, about having justice targets. So it's very supported by the Labor Party. It was in their election platform. So say the mob out there to please vote Labor in, because then we're more likely to get our justice targets. And what it is, it's about accountability.
Yeah.
We want, you know, to, rather than scouring through all these different reports in each state and territory, we want to see it in a document, and it needs to be tracked every year. We need to see what they're investing and where that's coming out. We want to see the improvements that we've seen in Aboriginal health through the Closing the Gap strategy. We want to see the same improvements in justice. And through the Change the Record Coalition, we've been asking for dual targets. So one target which aims to lower the incarceration rate, and another target that aims to lower the violence rate.
Yeah.
So, and that's recorded by people presenting to hospital with assaults, and people, you know, calling police for violence, those sorts of things, so they can be measured as well, because it's all about community safety. And just letting people out of prison might not necessarily make the community safer, but doing that in tandem with doing programs to stop repeat victimisation, which is particularly important for our women, we believe that will bring down the rates.
Yeah,
what we really need is a strategy.
Yeah, I would agree, because I was just going to say, like, you're talking about, we talked about Australia being praised for, you know, the $100 million domestic violence initiative, but if you're still locking up so many Aboriginal women, so many Aboriginal men, so many children are being taken away from their parents, I mean, it just doesn't fit to me that you're going to ever solve this problem around violence and family violence in our communities if the incarceration crisis is still so out of control.
Yeah, and they are linked. You know, when someone from a family gets put in prison, that breaks down family structures, puts enormous pressure on the single parent that's left to look after the children. So it is all connected, and that's why through the Change the Record Coalition we have been working with the Aboriginal Legal Services and the Family Violence Prevention Legal Services to develop policies that we think will meet both those needs. And what we've been saying to government and what we said to them over at the UN is, come and work with us. Come and talk to us. You know, we do have some solutions to our own issues. We just need you to listen.
Why do you think, I mean, you mentioned Nigel Scullion before. Why has this government been so antagonistic towards those sort of justice targets and a national justice framework?
Yeah, I think it's, again, this federal-state divide. They don't want to interfere in the business of the states. I also think that they know it's going to make them look bad. I don't, you know, I'm not inside Nigel Scullion's head or Tony Abbott or George Brandis, so I can't quite understand it, why they're saying, no, it will be a big investment. I mean, it was heaps of money that went into the Closing the Gap strategy, so it won't be an easy thing. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't look towards it. And we do need some sort of accountability. This is something we've been crying out for accountability on. And this would be a way for us to really easily compare the difference between the states and territories. So we just have to keep pushing on them for this. And we do have an election coming up. There is some hope there. But if the current government does stay in, we need to work with them as well. So, more work to do.
The Indigenous Advancement Strategy, you mentioned before Australia used it as sort of justification that it's doing positive things in Aboriginal affairs. Was that picked up by any of the member states, the problem around the problems around the AIS?
No, not the problems. They were all saying it was wonderful.
Oh, right. Well, that's a problem in itself.
Yes. Well, they were saying to continue on with the Indigenous Advancement Strategy. And, you know, the government kept talking about the same rhetoric we've been hearing. We're going to get kids into school, we're going to get adults into job, and we're going to create economic development, that sort of same rhetoric. And that's what they talked about with the IAS. So when the countries read this report and hear that, they think, oh, that's a good thing, let's keep that going.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we need... It all comes down to the lobbying before the UPR. So, like, we went and met with a lot of foreign embassies to tell them what we thought should be in it, and the NGO group did and others did. But if they didn't hear from civil society about particular issues, then it didn't make it in. And one of the issues that sadly occurred with is the removal of children, Aboriginal children.
Right.
So there's only one recommendation. It's from Paraguay. And it says to reduce the rate of family separation of Indigenous peoples caused, among others, by the removal of babies and children from their families and the imprisonment of juveniles and adults. I think that our lobbying on that issue could have been stronger. And, you know, we just encourage groups like Grandmothers Against Removals or SNAKE or any of the organisations working in a specific area to have the UPR in mind. Yeah. So when we come up for the next UPR, you can have done that targeted lobbying. You might go back and look at the countries which had concerns and write to them and thank them and say, this is what the situation is now. And we're all learning that, and hopefully more Indigenous people can be involved in the next UPR.
I think that's an important point because I think, I guess the National Congress particularly has been, I don't think there's a lot of understanding about what going to the international arena can actually do amongst our mob, because we don't see it and we don't see the outcomes and we don't see what's actually happening over there. So I know that was a key criticism of the National Congress, particularly that they were too focused on international human rights. But from your perspective, why is it so important, do you think, to have this sort of international focus and to be going over there and lobbying these states?
Well, it's about standard setting. So it's about having standards that all human beings can expect in every country that they go to. So it's really important that, for one, that Indigenous people and Australian Aboriginal people are involved in those standard setting. So that's a lot of what Les Mills has done. Like, he's been involved in drafting the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and making standards for the benefit of everyone. We need to be part of that. But we also need to be to work within the UN and bring that back home. I think that's what has been missing. I think there's been a lot of great advocacy done by Aboriginal people over the years at the UN, but sometimes that doesn't filter back. And once we do filter it back, there's enormous interest. Yeah. I mean, I live tweeted for 4 hours. I had heaps of followers. I had heaps of retweets. You know, we did the opinion pieces. We did videos. We sent it all back home. And I've had so many people say to me, thank you, because it makes the UN seem a lot more real then.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said before, about the UPR, that this isn't just some committee of the United Nations telling Australia what to do. This is our trade partners. These are our diplomatic ties, like America and New Zealand and Canada. These are countries of the world telling us to improve. So I think that's got a little bit more credit to it than just a committee of the UN.
I just wanted to ask one more question before I let you go, because I know you have to go take your daughter to school. But I just wanted, there wasn't a lot also on the WA remote closures, was there? Is that because it's just very much filtering along? People don't really know what's happening with the process at the moment?
Yeah, that, and I think probably a lack of coordinated advocacy as well. So they might not have done as much lobbying about the situation, but there were a couple of key questions, in particular the United States. They said that Australia should ensure that Indigenous peoples are consulted when considering the viability of remote communities, and that those affected by the closures of communities receive transitional support and unimpeded access to ancestral lands. There was a few others, like from Mexico, that talked about Indigenous people in remote areas. But the Australian government didn't respond at all to those. And the US question was actually really interesting, because there was a question posed in advance which specifically mentioned Umbulgari and asked about what the government was doing to oversee what the WA government was doing. And again, there was no response. When we had the UPR debrief session the following day, I put my hand up and asked, what's your response to remote communities? And I also asked about Indigenous incarceration, you know, not satisfied with the responses that they'd given with that same old rhetoric. And they answered a little bit about the incarceration questions in sort of circles and just avoided the remote question again.
Oh, right.
So there has been no response. So that's where you need to, like, write to government and say, you know, when are you going to respond, or, and advocate between now and March to make sure that that's one of the recommendations that's accepted.
Have you heard much from the Barnett government, just in your day job, about what's happening in relation to those remote closures. It's still under consultation, I imagine. That's where the sort of where it's at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So they appointed the advisory councils, which has four representatives from the Pilbara and the Kimberley. And we really haven't heard too much from them since they've been appointed. Marty Sibisato, who's one of the Kimberley appointed leaders, has come out speaking in a newspaper article, and that's about all I've seen. So we know that the consultation is continuing, but they really have changed their rhetoric. They're not talking about closing communities anymore. They're talking about reform. But we also know that at the same time, some of the recommendations from the Gordon Inquiry, which happened a long time ago, which is about family and domestic violence, that they're starting to be implemented, and they're starting to look at what sort of family and domestic violence is going on in particular communities. So we know that that's, yeah, we're watching that. We don't know whether the findings of that sort of consultation will result in certain communities being targeted over others. I mean, there's those questions, but then there's also the questions of economic sustainability. So the ones that don't have many houses or many people or associated infrastructure would probably be at risk as well. But really, we're all just in the dark a bit about it. They said that the consultation should finish in December, but the appointment of the advisory council came out like a month and a half late, so they're already behind the eight ball. So I anticipate it will just be extended for a bit longer, and they'll be very careful about the way that they talk about the situation. But we do need to know that there's a lot of time and effort and money being invested into looking at the situation, so it needs to be monitored carefully.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of our mob will keep the government on their toes as well, because I think there's also a few protests planned anyway. I think people aren't ready to give up yet the fight, and they're quite cynical still of what the Barnett government's going to do. So I think we'll still be seeing protests around the place regarding those forced closures.
Well, we've got the fifth global call to action for SOS Black Australia on the 27th of November. So there's a lot of events still happening. It's sort of, I think it's morphed a little bit from protest to sort of celebration of remote communities and pushing people to support them. But yeah, that's coming up, so people can get involved that way.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Tammy. I know it's very early over in Perth and it's your first day back at work, so I really appreciate you being on here for an hour this morning.
Yeah, no problem. It's great to be on the show, and thanks for sharing, you know, the work that we're doing and the United Nations work, and hopefully more people can get involved, because I'd love to see the next UPR where we have a whole delegation of Aboriginal people there doing lots of work and being really involved in the lobbying beforehand.
Yeah, I think it's really important, especially when we talked about the issues that were sort of overlooked just because there were so many other things to talk about. So thanks so much for that, Tammy, and hopefully we talk to you soon. But if we don't, I hope you have a good day and a good week and month. So
thanks, Amy. You too.
Thanks. Bye. For that.